It is March the 29th, 2019, and this is episode 8 of the official podcast of the Royal New Zealand College of Urgent Care. Hello and welcome to episode 8. This episode is a little different to normal in that it was recorded in front of a live audience at the Goodfellow Symposium last week. It is a discussion with Dr. John Bonning alongside our Director of Clinical Training, Dr. Dave Sorrell. We talk about investigating pulmonary embolisms, chest pain and head injury with respect to the rational use of health resources while still maintaining patient safety and satisfying clinician concerns. John Bonning is an emergency physician at Waikato Hospital, and he is the president-elect of the Australasian College of Emergency Medicine, the first New Zealander to be elected. He is the chair of the Council of Medical Colleges of New Zealand, a New Zealand Rugby Union match doctor, and police medical officer. He's an expert witness for the HDC and the coroner, and he's on the advisory group for Choosing Wisely New Zealand, and has represented New Zealand internationally in Choosing Wisely. My thanks to John for taking the time to join us for this talk, and as ever, thanks to Dave Sorrell. If we could just start with this case, if I was to present to you a 26-year-old female who's just returned from Dubai, having been on holiday, and she developed a cough while she was there, and that cough's got worse, it's now slightly productive, and she's got a pleuritic chest pain. She's not on the pill currently, and she's got no other risk factors, but she's got a low-grade fever, and somebody's done some bloods. There's a mild leukocytosis and a positive D-dimer, and they get referred up to your emergency department. Please rule out PE. Let's start there, shall we?
Yeah, clearly a very challenging case. So pulmonary embolus is the most overdiagnosed and underdiagnosed condition that is occasionally life-threatening that we see in emergency departments. And I think one of the main things that I'm keen to get across in this discussion is that we don't need to diagnose every PE, but we just need to diagnose the ones that count and look for it in people who really might be harmed if you miss it. And look at some other perspectives, such as in the US, where, and this is a quote from a medical paper, it's not me just inventing words, their current way of investigating and diagnosing pulmonary embolus is killing 6 times more patients than they are helping. So we are over looking for this disease, but it is really, really complex and it's difficult. So of course we need to remember DVT and PE are a continuum of the same disease as well. So obviously we're always looking for both conditions in any patient that presents with either. And then moving to the D-dimer, for example, and that's kind of one of the keys to this discussion. And how positive was it and how sensitive? So it's quite a sensitive test, but as we know, it's got very, very poor specificity. So it picks up a lot of non-disease and it's positive in many, many patients. And so you'll all know that 500 is the standard cutoff. However, there is now an age-corrected one and you can use age multiplied by 10 for positivity. So in a 70-year-old, 700 is the cutoff. And again, it just depends so much on that pretest probability, doesn't it? Whether they have a likelihood of the disease or not. And if you start investigating people who've got a very low probability of disease, you are way more likely to pick up non-disease and have false positive tests and investigations than you are that somebody that's got a high pretest probability. So for a start, as you see, you've got the PERC rule up there, and we tend to need med calculators. Your gestalt would probably include all of these factors, but the Medi-Cal apps on your phones and on your desktops will often have these, and you can flick through them as you're going from one disease to the next. But as you can see up there, and age under 50, heart rate less than 100, and you might say, well, at what point was it ever was it ever greater than 100? And it's 101 positive, but 99's negative. Again, that can be challenging. Oxygen saturation's got to be greater than 95% on room air. No unilateral leg swelling. So this person, you must examine carefully her legs, see if there's any suggestion of DVT there. No hemoptysis, no previous trauma or surgery, no prior PE or DVT. And we'll all know that once you've had the disease, you tend to be prone to getting it again. And no hormone use. And the only other thing I'd sort of throw in there is in the decision instrument talking about immobility and long-haul flights. It's greater than 6 hours. However, if you have a walk of more than a few steps, potentially more than just walking to the toilet from your seat in the aeroplane, if you walk in that 6 hours, the clock can be reset. And again, just got to be very careful the way you apply these decision instruments. And I really like to call them decision instruments. They're not rules. They're things that frame our decision making. So, yeah, I mean, this patient, Dave, I think it was one of your patients, was it? This young
Dave,
girl.
Yeah. Just introducing Dave Sorrell for the listeners at home. Dave, our director of clinical training.
It wasn't, but I had a patient extremely similar to this who I falsely diagnosed pneumonia in with the X-ray findings, and it turned out to be extensive bilateral PEs. The thing with using these scores, which is really good, is remember that it says hormone, but actually it means estrogen. So pregnancy is estrogen. There's been a recent study looking at PE and DVD post-termination of pregnancy. It's also got very high rates. So the word estrogen, it means pregnancy as well. And how positive is the D-dimer? And I assumed that an infection could produce a very high D-dimer, which was my false cognition that if you've got 2,000 D-dimer, then you should probably start investigating.
So just specifically that patient that you're talking about, how soon after was that diagnosis made? And did she get sick or did she not respond to your initial therapy?
So she didn't respond to antibiotics and she represented to the emergency department. Where
roughly
working.
How many days later?
It was 2 days later.
A couple of days later. Yeah. And things become clearer. And another thing that we need to understand perspective as well. And Miles' Law, I like quoting, it's where you stand depends on where you sit. Miles was a bureaucrat in the Truman era government just after the war. And that's a very prescient statement because in primary care, urgent care, you're going to see so many people without the disease and a tiny, tiny portion of people with the disease. In emergency departments, just a little few more people with the disease, but you talk to a respiratory physician or a hematologist and they're just seeing swathes of people with the disease. And so you are seeing all those really, really low pretest probability patients. And so what I was alluding to, how soon afterwards you would have had some shared decision-making discussion with this patient and actually told them that pulmonary embolus was on your differential potentially. You might not have, but the fact that you did a D-dimer would indicate to me that you were thinking of it. And again, that your documentation says that you thought of it, that you examined the legs and that you looked for the other aspects of the PERC rule, again, protects you. Because we would like to also... the HDC and coroners and various other regulatory people and lawyers are down our, we feel like they're on our shoulders looking over every decision we make. But to be very, very clear, to rule out every possible sinister cause of disease and every possible patient every time you see them is not good medical practice. And this is from lawyers and the HDC. And again, we've got the tension between under-investigation, missing serious diagnoses, and over-investigation, exposing patients to unnecessary risks and unnecessary procedures. And we're getting more and more sensitive with our ability to investigate pulmonary embolus. And, you know, the question, how many lakes are there in Scandinavia? Well, it depends how many, what your definition of a lake is and how powerful your microscope, your telescope is. And, of course, with our CTs now, we're picking up many, many PEs that are tiny, tiny, inconsequential. And I'd suggest that most people that come off long-haul flights will have a degree of DVT. We all, you know, if you have a flight longer than 10 hours, your shoes are tight at the end of it, you're going to have a bit of clot in your leg and probably a little in your lungs, feel a little bit short of breath. We clear it. The lungs are there to do that. So a lot of them, they're being cleared. So, you know, this is a really challenging patient.
And in your choosing wisely remit, there is actually that flip side. We're worried about missing a diagnosis, but there is that flip side of over-diagnosing and causing harm through over-investigating, and that we have to be aware of equally.
Absolutely. John, did you have a question?
Yes. I don't understand. Is this woman got a negative PERC score or not? I mean, did you do that, use that tool?
So the case I presented there was a hypothetical case, although it matched a case that Dave had had.
Yes, well, and if we focus on David's case, then... Yep.
They're not the same case, so this case presented
doesn't matter on your one, just a minute,
negative
on your
PERC.
One. Did she fail or pass the PERC test, and she had a positive D-dimer? I know it's confusing because she had a temperature. And
so this was prior to the PERC rule being available. This is around about 2003.
And you still remember all those cases, don't you? And remember, PERC is applied before you do a D-dimer.
Yeah.
So PERC is in order to not do a D-dimer.
This was Wells' scoring system. And interestingly, I do remember, you remember the cases, you had this list, and I remember the guy who made my kitchen bench, who was a very talented carpenter. He made a kitchen bench out of American oak, and he had his varicose veins stripped, and his first visit back to the surgeon, he collapsed in the waiting room and died of a massive PE. And he'd had some minor surgery, and he had distended veins, and he had a catastrophic PE. So that wasn't the patient I managed, but I was trying to find out why the kitchen wasn't being finished, and had to talk to his widow in the driveway of the house and things. So,
well, I think with the Wells test, there is still a guidance on the issue of the D-dimer. If a D-dimer has been done already and it is positive, well, you may be forced up a path where you have to...
Yeah, and that was part of the point here, was to say this lady was PERC negative with this hypothetical lady, with a potential for a diagnosis of infection being quite high. But in a similar case, Dave's had gone on to become a PE, and that's what we're fearful of. We're fearful of that negative, but if this person has then had the D-dimer, they're then, when they didn't need it, they then end up in an emergency department getting that full workup, and then it falls to sometimes an emergency physician to make the decision to ignore that D-dimer.
There are patients. So remember, in the Wells DVT score, you've got alternative diagnosis as likely as DVT. And in this case of the febrile sputum patient, that a chest infection is likely. So there's a couple of things I want to throw in here. One is that we just must not do a D-dimer on a no pretest probability patient. And this is not a no pretest probability patient, but it will set off that bit of a diagnostic cascade. But we do see patients that have a positive, potentially weekly positive, 700 or something like that, that might have another reason for it. And then that's when you have the shared discussion with the patient to understand what their knowledge of the risk. And if you throw in something like pregnancy into this as well, where there really is risk to the mother and the fetus of radiation, it really makes investigation and the concept of harm of investigations, which is another really key thing I'm trying to get across. There is harm in investigating patients. Radiation dose, incidental OMA findings. So, incidental OMAs, I actually consent patients now, well before I talk about radiation dose, of the possibility of finding something abnormal that's going to worry you. And I've got countless examples of where people have been harmed by tests and investigations. For example, I've got a series of 1,000 neck CTs done for trauma in Melbourne. 200 of them have had some sort of thyroid nodule or abnormality in them. And up to 90, some studies quote 96% of CT scans, pan CT scans done in trauma will have an incidental OMA. The other day I had to explain to a 14-year-old girl that the little nubbin of tissue around her pituitary was probably a non-functioning pituitary adenoma, but she was going to need a few tests for it and what bitempial hemianopia was and the fact that every time she got a headache it wasn't her brain tumour. I mean, she needed the scan for her head injury. She'd flipped a bike, a BMX bike, and landed on her head and had quite a few abnormalities at the time. The CT was otherwise normal apart from this incidental OMA. So just remember the harm of over-testing.
Hi, I'm from Wellsford and I'm an hour north of Auckland. 2 points. One, what's your thoughts on Wells score versus Geneva scores? And secondly, we've got point of care D-dimers, and if they're greater than 500, they're considered positive regardless of the age corrected, and we're forced into a management, I suppose.
So a couple of things. So yeah, I've got these different scores here, and it probably doesn't, I can't quote the exact sensitivity and specificities of each decision instrument, and probably use some decision instrument to guide your gestalt. And Wells versus Geneva, they ask similar sort of things. There's age-related stuff, there's previous surgery, there's cancer, all those. So that is just something to frame your gestalt. So it doesn't matter which one, call it a decision instrument, not a rule. And then I would say quite strongly that it is now well backed in the literature that you can use an age-corrected D-dimer. So in a 70-year-old, you're allowed 700, and that is well backed in the literature now. I've got a bunch of notes here that through Guy I'm happy to make available to the group afterwards for the podcast as well. So you have to know a little bit about your test characteristics as well, because there are numerous different types of D-dimer, and the point of care ones might have slightly differing results as well. So, and occasionally, so that patient that you'll send to North Shore Hospital may well get a repeat D-dimer done with a different assay, which might be negative. Again, if you think that the patient is a low pretest probability and that you think that the D-dimer is spurious.
I'm just interested, John, in the defending yourself should anything do go to custard further down the line, when you're seeing them on day one and you've got a justification for not going down that diagnostic pathway, maybe initially, documentation is obviously an important thing, and that's defensible when it ends up in front of HDC.
Indeed, and shared decision making. So another quote that I've got here. So I've, in our world, we've got people like Jeff Klein, who's an emergency physician from the US, who's just all over this research and does massive amount of research. He came down and spoke at one of our conferences in Queenstown 2016, and I spoke to him extensively about this. And one of his quotes is, if you've thought about PE, they won't die from it. Okay, because the massive ones that are going to be life-threatening are going to be so obvious, and those sort of subtle ones. Now you need to have a discussion with the patient and let them know it's one of the diagnostic possibilities, and then you go down the line of treatment or time, and then give them time and action specific follow-up instructions of when to come back. And I'm quite specific in the discharge letters that I do is, see your GP in 2 days, or if you get worse, come back to the emergency department. Not just say, if no better, see your GP, not the sort of send them out into the ether. And there are people, like me that do most of the reports I do for the HDC are obviously on other emergency physicians. You should be judged by your peers who understand you and not some sort of super specialist. If your documentation has indicated you've thought about it, you've examined the leg, you took the pulse, say if it was 110, you thought, well, she's febrile, I think it's pneumonia, perhaps you had the chest x-ray, it showed that little bit of abnormality. As long as that patient isn't, got a respiratory rate of 30 and sats in the low 90s and looking an extremist, which are unlikely to be, you're not going to get adversely judged. And I'd like to think that you're well protected there. for those patients, and that we don't need to diagnose everything first time. And again, all the inpatient specialists in hospitals see so much disease. You know, the orthopods saying that we miss all these, you know, cervical spine fractures, the subtle ones, and that they see so much disease that we've got to remember the spectrum of patients without disease that we see. And so documentation, shared decision making, and giving the patient invested in that decision and saying it might be this. And if they say, you know, if the patient says, "I'm really, really, really worried," send them on. It's the ones that are, you know, they're not even this sort of risk. You know, we are getting. You know, I had an 18-year-old girl send up the other day with chest pain, so please do troponins and rule out acute coronary syndrome. You know, a European girl with no risk factors whatsoever. So that sort of thing as well. And we've got to remember the perspective of the different patients we're talking about. And you all have in your mind this patient, that you'll have seen that patient, that it really could have been something else, but it was PE. But don't frame your entire practice around, you know, every 26-year-old has got to have a D-dimer. And I'm sure you don't, but it's just, you know, there's harm of testing. In America, they test and scan so many more people than need to be. We're pretty pragmatic and good. Our CTA PA positivity rate in this country hovers around 15%, so it still means 85% of them are going to be negative. In the US, it's below 5%. In Nelson Hospital, they had about a 20% positivity rate, and you'd start to think, well, perhaps you should scan a few people more. But, you know, there are not people out there dropping dead from their small subsegmental PEs, but they will continue to have symptoms, and then you'll investigate them. And again, you'll be very used to getting patients back to your practice in a couple of days for a bit of a checkup and follow-up, and that's very important.
And pulmonary embolisms are linked to the next topic of chest pain, and there's a similar blood test to the D-dimer in respect of it can open up a can of worms potentially. So chest pain and troponins.
Indeed, and once again, there are scoring systems. There's the heart score and there's the EDAC score, and again, just find a score or a decision instrument to help frame your work. Looking at it, it'll be similar to your gestalt, so you don't necessarily need to use that. But then the key thing here is that at the top of the page on this that we have here is cardiac ischemia is the suspected cause of the chest pain. If cardiac ischemia is not the suspected cause of the chest pain, don't do the troponin. And of course, the troponitis is out there and rampant in all patients with, particularly with a bit of renal impairment and the older you get. And there's a lot of patients that come in and their troponins just steadily sits at 30 or whatever. I think there's slightly differing, there's I's and T's, so the reference range might be slightly different as I quote any numbers at you. But it's about not doing the troponins if you're not thinking ischemia. Just an elderly person with the dwindles who's had a bit of a collapse, don't do a troponin in that patient unless you suspect acute coronary syndrome or cardiac ischemia. Of course, a lot of old people are going to have some degree of ischemia. But then there's the kind of, you know, the 40, 50, 60-year-olds. And again, there's harm of starting that diagnostic cascade in these people. The cardiologists have what's called the oculostentic reflex. And as soon as they see any sort of lesion in the coronary, so if you get down to CT coronary angiography and they see a 60% lesion, they'll put a stent in it. Maybe less than that. And then that patient's then got a stent and needing to be on anticoagulants for the rest of their life. And it may well have been a stable narrowing that they were going to take to their grave much later. And again, the previous talk in this room was about prostate screening as well. So screening people with low probability of disease will find up with many more patients without the disease. So again, use the decision instrument and do troponins, being wary of the significant cause of false positives and not doing them in no pretest probability patients.
And how do you then differentiate maybe historically or clinically from the suspected cardiac pain when it could have an atypical origin, you know, these sorts of inferior MIs that present as abdominal pain or some of the weird ones that you hear about?
Indeed.
Those are the ones we're thinking, but they're obviously.
And, you know, we know that we are less good at diagnosing acute coronary syndrome in women. We are less good at diagnosing acute coronary syndrome in Māori and Pacifica patients. And you have to have that sort of... But the more experienced you get, The more that you talk to them, and again, make it very, very clear at the end of a discussion, if you think, well, I don't think this is your heart at this stage, and I'm not going to expose you to the very, very poorly sensitive test, the treadmill test, which is not very good at picking up disease either, and then the highly sensitive test of the CTs. And, you know, I've had mates in their 40s that have ended up with CTs, and you know, one of them, you know, had the angiogram and it was completely clear because I was riding my mountain bike with him the week previously. He didn't have any acute coronary syndrome, but a slightly abnormal ECG, and he fainted afterwards and got his big hematoma on his head, full of anticoagulants and what have you. It wasn't too much harm, but again, this harm of testing some of these patients. So you need to talk to the patient, say that your diagnosis is not definitive. At this time, we do not think you have the disease. I'm thinking of this. These are the sorts of symptoms going forward that I might expect you to have, and document that in your notes. But being, yes, again, very, very clear about women who have the highest false positivity rates in exercise treadmill tests as well, again, which is a very, very poor test. But just, we need to... only put patients up to the cardiologist that you truly think might have the disease, and being wary of that downflow effect of the harm of some of the investigations.
I've got a question for John. This is regarding the EDAC score that you have here. I think the EDAC score was sort of, the idea is for a low-risk person to be checked in ED and to have a troponin done, and whether they can be discharged on a single troponin or not.
Yes, so I'd like to acknowledge that I know many of you will work in a situation where you can't do any form of observation. You might have a lab test, it might not come back till tomorrow. And again, it's just us understanding your perspective. And sending patients up to the emergency department where they'll commonly get two troponins. However, often... they'll arrive and they'll get an ECG, again, which is a cheap and effective. ECGs are good things to do. They're not particularly harmful, and they should be done on most of these patients, if not all, with chest pain. They've often get a troponin before I even get to see them, and then you'll have that single. But I am discharging very low pretest probability patients that I probably think didn't necessarily even need the test if they're low pretest probability and negative. But then if they come back positive, you probably have to do another one. And I'm sometimes surprised, but not crazily. You know, it'll be somebody in their 50s and the 60s that I thought, you know, was very, very atypical, and you do a second one and it's gone up. But it's pretty rare. But don't frame your practice about that kind of unicorn patient. You know, there are horses, and we see lots of horses, occasional zebras, but very few unicorns. So, don't frame your practice around the unicorns.
Any other questions? Should we move on to head injuries now, because I know, Dave, that's your area of personal interest here. CT heads in the community are not possible, so we need to determine who we need to send to ED for CT heads. But there's also the people who don't need CT heads who we observe. So my question would be, how long do you observe a patient for after a head injury?
Well, the very first thing that I say, that if any of my registrars, house officers come to me and say, I'm performing 4 hours observation on this head injury, I give them a gentle figurative slap and say, now where did you get that number from? They got it from nowhere. All right, so there's no such thing as 4 hours observation. There is observation for a clinically appropriate amount of time. Now, if this person had high-risk features, lives a long way away, perhaps is on anticoagulants, is older, it might be 24 hours. But then, you know, remember back in the day, and you may remember if you did some practice in emergency departments sort of 15, 20 years ago, the kids would be racing around the emergency department having their neurological observations. You'd have to catch them to do the neurological observations. Okay, so it's not about doing those. So, I think Dave would be quite keen to talk about this. The whole issue of concussion is a really, really serious thing that I think we're getting a lot more serious, a lot more knowledgeable about. And we get so focused on that period of observation and the CT scan to rule out something really quite significant, remembering that even in New Zealand, we're only finding abnormalities in less than 10% of patients that we CT scan, and neurosurgical abnormalities in less than 2%. And of course, in America, everybody's just lit up. And, focusing on on concussion and what that is and those sorts of decisions that you make and then appropriate follow-up, I think, is more important. But we do, you think a little bit about the CTs, and again, we acknowledge and understand that you don't necessarily have somewhere you can observe somebody, even for half an hour. You know, that person actually looks fine, not too high a risk, but they're just repeating themselves over and over again. Remember, it's a physiological derangement, not necessarily a structural. So don't focus only on the structural. Think about the physiological. And then they don't necessarily need to come up for their CTs, but are going to need some ongoing follow-up. But the Canadian CT instruments is actually going to make us scan a whole truckload of people that perhaps we don't need to. So you need to be fairly pragmatic about it. So, you know, these decision instruments are designed to pick up 100% of patients with any abnormality, but they've still only got 10% positivity. And so quite often we do turn patients around in 5 or 10 minutes that have been sent up for some observation, because things become clearer with time, don't they? All right, and you haven't got the so hopefully nobody's getting criticised for doing that when they can't observe them, and it frustrates me a wee bit. And I'm sure you don't say go up to the hospital and get your CT scan, but patients often come up with a bit of an expectation. Sometimes it's a little bit tough to turn that off, but try not to send them up with an expectation. And the other thing that I'm very clear about is when they get sent up and we turn them around fairly rapidly, I say, look, I'm really, really glad that the urgent care doctor or the GP sent you up. Because they were clearly worried about you, had these sort of symptoms and signs at the time that now seem to have cleared. We see a lot of patients with this, and we're comfortable with the decision not to make a CT. So we never say, oh, those idiots, what did they send you up for? But, you know, I promise you we don't do that. I don't. Dave, the concussion, you know, a really serious issue, and don't get so focused on the CT.
My unique perspective on seeing lots of concussion patients. I think that, again, you're using a risk stratification. And when you've got an elderly person on anticoagulants, we know that a recent meta-analysis of head injuries show 1 in 9 of them will have a significant bleed. Now, that's a huge number. So when you've got someone who's had a significant head injury, whatever that means, and they're on anticoagulants, they're very high risk. Your other patients, you're waiting until they're feeling better. So sometimes you'll see a kid and they're running around, and if they've never had any significant signs in the history, so they weren't quiet, they weren't sleepy, they haven't vomited, they have what I describe as a minimal head injury. That's not concussion at all at this stage. They may have the mythical delayed concussion, so they feel worse. I just call it Mondayizing. So they hit the head at rugby on Saturday, and on Monday they go to stall and vomit. Those kids are going to be okay, but they should be reviewed. It's very important that your patients with obvious concussion are followed up very closely and have appropriate follow-up. And there's some really interesting stuff that's coming about. Most interesting thing I read on Thursday was that social media is so ingrained in kids and teenagers that they get socially isolated if they're not able to go back onto social media. And that sort of changed around my concept of screen time. Yes, the blue light of screens is not good for the recovery of concussion, and there are various reasons for that. But isolation from their socialization is a bad thing. Return to exercise, very, very, very interesting stuff. 72 hours of rest and then get back into sub-symptomatic exercise. So we exercise people more and more earlier and earlier so their brain can recover. And really, I'm never sending, well, no, I'm not never. I'm sending my patients on anticoagulants in for a CT, and everyone else I'm seeing that they can be observed and feel better. And the PCAN rule for children is so much better than the CHALIS because they opt for observation over CT early. And the interesting stuff from recent studies are talking about the hematoma, which we still don't even know what a significant childhood hematoma is. Is it 3 centimetres? Is it 5 centimetres? One of the things that's very interesting is that delayed presentation has much higher rates of structural brain injury than early presentation, and that amnesia, if it resolves, is never significant. So observation, They come out of amnesia. They stop saying, what happened to me? What happened to me? What happened to me? In my night shifts in the emergency department, I had a little bit of fun from time to time telling people a different story every time they asked what happened to them. I don't think you're really allowed to do that, but it is quite interesting.
Oh, you can have lots of fun carefully. But absolutely fantastic. And, you know, the vomits, you know, they've had one vomit and they look terrible at the time, but then often straight after the first vomit, they're okay. And you can maybe have two, you know, and it sort of says, less than two vomits. And you have two and then you stop and then you're fine, you're probably okay, but then they go and have a third, then you send them up. So, again, these are decision instruments. They're not categorical rules. Time declares things really, really clearly one way or the other. By the time they've got up to us, some more time has elapsed, so it becomes clearer whether things are needed. And, of course, I completely agree. Flashing back a little bit to our previous discussion about chest pain, having everybody on anticoagulants every time they knock their head, they're going to need a CT scan. So don't get them onto the anticoagulants by not falsely diagnosing something that was going to be stable and not harmful. But so anybody on any form of the newer novel anticoagulants, they're not so new anymore, and clearly Coumadin, usually gets a scan. But you could argue that they need a scan in 24 hours because of those slow, the old patient, the slow developing subdurals. And the other thing I'm very, very careful with my elderly patients is, and again, we've all seen these patients that have a bit of a knock, maybe even had a normal first CT scan, and then they just go off the boil over about 6 or 7 or 8 days, and they've got those subdurals that turn up later. So nursing home patient that goes to ground, again, you'll be confronted with a lot of these sorts of patients. When do you CT? There's no sign of trauma on them, but then over the next few days, if they start to deteriorate, subdurals on your list of things that you need to rule out. So it's not necessarily that immediate CT in the older patient with those little walnuts for brains and that are on anticoagulants.
So my question was about SCAT3s. Is it SCAT4s now?
Yeah. So
is it five now?
Version 5. However, there's a HIA 1, 2, and 3. So we do the pitch side 1, and then there's the number 2 and the number 3. And again, they're not they're done as you recover. The pitch side is about your Maddox questions and some coordination and recall. And no, it's quite hard to do actually. You read start off by reading 3 numbers of them. They've got to read them back to you. Then you read 4 numbers, and they've got to read them back. And you end up by doing 7 numbers. If I was to read 7 numbers out to each one of in the audience and get you immediately in your mind to say them back to me in reverse, you'd probably struggle. So we are actually removing a lot of people at the time. And so I'm talking about the representative rugby. And we sit there, we've got 7 screens in front of us and watching every replay back and forth and really trying to do that. But clearly, 95% of rugby is not going to have that, and particularly schoolboy, schoolgirl rugby, and other injuries as well. Girls are still well represented. Yeah, and look, it's those delayed presentations. As I said, there's no such thing as delayed concussion. Concussion is concussion. New symptoms are ongoing or not. They might be slightly mild initially, but then get worse. That is just concussion. And as Dave alluded to, if you're still significantly symptomatic at 5 days, maybe you do get a CT scan at that because of that risk of structural problems. And then, you hear of these tragedies of these. At what stage did that boy die? Was it within 24, 48 hours? Or?
Now, I've just had to make a couple of little edits here, partly because one half of the conversation was not mic'd, so you could not hear it, but also because it referenced a specific case. The essence of the question was a delayed bleed and second impact syndrome in a rugby player.
Yeah. So the second concussion, whatever you like to label that as. So yeah, somebody that's had an injury and then has another one, and maybe they have some sort of, a structural abnormality. Dave, did you want to mention that?
So there's an interesting paper that came up talking about second impact syndrome, which is what everyone's worried about. In actual fact, what they're saying, this is first impact syndrome, but it's a catastrophic brain event, and it's got usually nothing to do with the previous event, that it's just one event that's catastrophic. However, there are some minor subdurals and other injuries that do occur, but you're never going to pick them up. So in actual fact, probably not best to think about second impact syndrome. That it's a it's a catastrophic brain injury with massive dysregulation and brain swelling, etc. If they're going to get a subarachnoid hemorrhage, sentinel bleed type thing, that's not going to be something you're going to be able to pick up. The reason we don't want them to go back to sport too soon is that there will be a cascade that eventually these people who get recurrent concussive injuries no longer recover, and they pretty much will get a chronic traumatic encephalopathy because they no longer recover from their concussive events.
One more question.
I've got two questions. One was the child that had a head injury, which you're moderately worried about, has had one vomit, feels nauseous. Sometimes give ondansetron, but kind of sometimes feel uncomfortable about it. Do you think that's kind of appropriate?
Certainly treat the symptoms regardless. Give them pain relief, give them something for their nausea, although we all know that antiemetics aren't wonderful drugs in general. So don't be afraid, never be afraid of treating symptoms to mask something, okay? You're never going to mask a brain injury that stops them vomiting with an antiemetic, A, because antiemetics aren't as that effective, and B, if there's structural problems, they will continue to vomit and be symptomatic. Never, always treat their symptoms.
There is no studies that have actually looked into that. So with review of the predict delayed presentation of head injury, and they did look at that, there is no answer either way. I have seen people with so-called mask symptoms, but no, it was the fact that they were in a coma in a suture room that there was actually masking all their symptoms. So if you're thinking that you have to give an antiemetic, think, why am I having to give an antiemetic? So if they're up to their fifth vomit, despite the antiemetic, that's the thing that you're worried about. If you have to think to give an antiemetic, think, why am I giving an antiemetic? Is it because they're up to their fourth or fifth vomit?
Agree.
And my other question is sort of the elderly person who's on an anticoagulant. You've done the scan, the scan's negative, and you know, so there's a wide range of conditions people take it for. So do you stop the anticoagulants for certain things because the head injury was significant?
Yeah, look, and that's a tough balance, and I can't give you an absolute rigid answer for that. If they're on it for atrial fibrillation, wouldn't you feel terrible if they went off it and had a stroke 2 days later? Having said that, you'd be surprised. We all know that our patients aren't stunningly compliant to their medications at all times. The older the patient, for example, you know, we're getting 80, 90-year-olds on anticoagulants now. You might think, well, do the risks of further falls outweigh the benefits of being on the drug? And you have to have that conversation with them, because if they do have a catastrophic ischemic stroke soon after you stop that, you know, you've got to have been able to sort of explain that to them. So the answer is possibly sometimes, but not always, depending on how bad the injury was in the first place.
So are they inappropriately anticoagulated is more of a question. And if they're on polypharmacy and one of those is an anticoagulant and they have high falls risk, that's what you're reviewing, not that individual head injury. And of course, if they've got a bleed, you're probably going to stop the anticoagulant because they're going to bleed to death inside their skull. So that's a hematological question and a neurosurgical question, the management of that particular bleed.
Hi, my question's about the Canadian CT head rule, and I know the theme here is really to take each patient by the merit, but I get quite frustrated with the over 65 bit of the CT head and, you know, obviously being worried in the community about missing something if the patient looks otherwise well. How much weight should we add to that?
So once again, as you say, over 65, high risk criteria, so everybody gets a CT, but how bad was the fall in the first place? That's whether or not you apply the decision instrument. Not a rule, it's an instrument, whether you put them into that for all of these things, for pulmonary embolus, for DVT, for cardiac chest pain. It's, you know, if it really was quite a trivial fall and they're in their 70s and there's not a mark on them and they'll look absolutely fine, don't even consider it. So it's whether you apply, you know, whether you think to apply it. It's not every person with head injury must apply this to, the cardiac, chest pain, and pulmonary embolus. So don't apply the test if you think it's that low a pretest probability, because as you say, it just digs you into a corner, into doing D-dimers, into that diagnostic cascade that in a low pretest probability patient has the potential to cause more harm by investigating.
So to enter into that, they have to have concussive symptoms. So if they've got a minimal traumatic brain injury and they're over 65, but if they've got symptoms, so remember the safety netting, if you start vomiting, if you are becoming drowsy. So yes, the patient who has significant concussive symptoms and is over the age of 65 has an increased risk of bleed and does need to be observed. So as a doctor who was treating concussion, I've retired from that aspect because it's just too hard. If I am seeing a patient who has got significant symptoms and is over 65 and hasn't had a CT, I am worried about subdural, because the very first autopsy I attended was a subdural hematoma, and it's burned into my skull literally. But you know, they've got significant symptoms. So the other thing about the Canadian CT head rule is it's completely incorrect in its acknowledgement that loss of consciousness is required. That does reduce the risk, but I've seen lots of patients with epidurals even who've had no loss of consciousness.
John, you're now the president-elect of the Australasian College of Emergency Medicine, and I know that you personally are very supportive of urgent care, and you certainly see emergency medicine as part of the primary care team. You're very approachable when we have diagnostic questions like this. So if we're struggling with a question, does this person meet this criteria, or what? You certainly welcome calls to the emergency department within reason.
Indeed.
And you would be, in your new role, hoping to spread that to the emergency departments.
Most definitely.
They're approachable places.
Understanding that perspective of people in primary care, urgent care, general practice. As you'll know from phoning all sorts of specialists, you'll get a varying from extremely helpful to extremely unhelpful advice. So just specifically in an emergency department, hopefully there is, you do feel you have some access to your local emergency physician. Look, they generally will be incredibly busy when you call them, and that's okay, you're busy as well. And we don't want to hear about everybody you're sending up. If you think they need a scan, a test, whatever, just send them up with an appropriate referral. Remembering emergency medicine, you know, toxicology, head injury, and all these, and actually ruling out ischemic heart disease in patients that don't have proven disease is more us than cardiology. We are happy to take some phone calls if you want some advice, if you're uncertain. Unfortunately, emergency departments are getting busier and busier. Hopefully somebody can give you advice. I'm very happy to. Hopefully most of my colleagues are. I will be spreading that word. We need, it's in the patient's best interest. It's to help and support you make decisions. Really hope that we can be a positive understanding of your perspective and help you with those, not the ones with clearly with the disease, not the ones that clearly don't have disease, the ones you're not sure about, do I send, perhaps I could send them tomorrow. Those sorts of questions, might help us all. So, open lines of communication.
So, do we err on the side of caution is a phrase you're not particularly fond of.
Defensive medicine can be offensive medicine. So just be careful, and you don't need to diagnose every serious condition in every patient every time you see them. Time, things declare themselves, involve the patients in the decision-making process so they understand. And occasionally things will go wrong, but hopefully not often. Don't be doing, a raft of tests on everybody, who might have the disease, thinking every chest pain might be an aortic dissection. Well, I don't think so.
So thank you, John, for being here today. We could probably talk to you for several hours more. This talk will live on in podcast form, and that's one of the aims of the talk here, was just to demonstrate that we've had this chat, but people can now listen back to it in the future, go back over what you've said, refresh themselves, and people who aren't here will hopefully benefit from it. And then if you have questions, one of the things I'm keen is for people to email the podcast with questions about clarifications of things, and then in the future we could come back and catch up with questions from the community, the people who aren't here who have questions for you or for your specialty and any other specialty, and create that kind of loop of constant learning and ongoing continuing medical education. So hopefully you've all learned something today and can continue to learn something. And just a big thank you to John for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
My thanks once again to John and Dave for their input. Thanks also to the people who asked questions during the discussion. Given the length of the talk, there'll be no nurses' station, news or emails this week, but we will be back next week with an urgent bite as usual. For episode 9 at the end of April, we'll have all the normal features, but we'll be splitting the podcast in two to make the listening to the CME content and the discussion a little more convenient. If you have any feedback, questions or comments on today's episode, please email the podcast at podcast@rnzcuc.org.nz. So we'll be back next week with another podcast. I look forward to seeing you all then. But for now, thanks for listening. The information discussed in this podcast was intended for the ongoing professional development of qualified health professionals and should not be used for self-diagnosis. For any personal medical concerns, please consult your usual doctor.